This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
All right.
Good morning, all.
Our third books and authors. We are just clipping along here, moving through our series. So excited for our conversation this morning.
Couple of business items. I mentioned earlier, as we're walking in, we are doing a drawing for a set of all four books and authors' books.
We'll do that at the end of June after our final event.
So if you haven't dropped your name and phone number in the basket. You get an entry for every single one you come to, so up your chances of getting a set of books. So please do that. We will have copies available after this morning. I'm an inning slate. There's a definitely a slate from my personal copy of Hillary's book and backlash week when I was selling things. So if you got my copy, if there's a large Marginalia, please find me afterwards. You did not pay for a used copy and I will swap you the one of the ones in use. Please find me afterwards. You did not pay for a used copy and I will swap you the one of the ones in use. Please give that back to me. I will get you the clean, fresh copy that you pay for. So please, if you go home and find that, that is mine and I will give you what should be yours.
No, I know. I was like, this is going to be like the Father Chuck Bible at the youth fundraiser that went for way more than it was, but it was Father Chuck. So it went for the highest selling item. Well, I'm so glad to have Dr. Hillary Yancey with us this morning. Her background is in philosophy, particularly ethics and ability studies, and she is here to talk to us this morning about her book, Forgiving God. Which is a story of her family and the birth of her first born son, Jack, who was diagnosed with a number of different disabilities that I'll just mention. And about her and her sister of faith and hard-won faith. And just exist together as a family, through that journey. So we have her here, like I said, she's at the seminary. Thank you. It's a great to be here. Thanks for being here.
It's so good to be here. This is fun. Good. Well, I want to begin. Folks in the room haven't read the book yet. Okay. So I think first things first is just tell us about Jack.
So my son Jack is now 10, going on 11. So this book chronicles him at the earliest stages of his life. So if you were to meet Jack today, he is far more of everything that he is than what I was able to express in that book 8 years ago. So Jack is a hilarious, creative, wise-hearted, very sassy 10-year-old. The things that probably are noticeable about Jack right away is that he has both a tracheostomy tube and a G button. So he eats and breathes a little bit differently than everybody else. And those things have been true since he was about three weeks old. So he had those surgeries really early. And that shaped a lot of our family routines, the kinds of things we think about, talk about, the kinds of ways that we are together. He has two younger sisters who are eight and six. And Jack was born, as I talk about in the book, with something called craniofacial microsomia, which it turns out is just a medical translation of basically a smallness of the craniofacial
part of his body. So he was born with growth having been restricted on one side of his face.
So he is missing his right eye and his right external and middle ear.
And then a number of bones in the right side of his jaw and cheek area were formed very, very small.
So essentially non-functional.
They exist, sort of, but they can't do lots of the things that it turns out our jaws are needed to do.
Like keep our tongues forward in our mouth so that we don't have an obstruction of our airway.
And so the trachea and the jeep were largely in response to those congenital challenges, and then they have freed him in lots of ways for a more typical progress of development in terms of being able to get nutrition and breathe easily.
Jack is autistic and somewhat nonverbal, so we have our own languages and styles of communication, and that can always be a really rewarding but really challenging experience.
It takes time to get to know what he wants to tell you.
But he has a lot to say.
That's very true.
Yes.
One of my favorite things learned from you in the book is how musical Jack is.
Can you tell us a little bit about musical music? Yes.
So we used to sing to him all the time. That was kind of one of the first languages, right? And it transcends so much of what we want to communicate with our words. And I think when our words often fail for all of us,
music is a different language we can offer.
And Jack just loves it.
He has an intrinsically very good sense of rhythm.
And so from the time he was walking with a beat, he loves opera, he loves classical music.
He is taken with conducting.
And so one year for his birthday, we got him a real conductor's baton.
And he conducts.
Growing conversation in church and religious spaces, about discipling other sorts of long-term, whether it's illness or challenges in life, that don't go away on a short time. I think about any Kenny's body as a request, or your neighbors, everything happens for a reason. Would you like to share stories about times when the church has failed you in your family journey and other times when it's really upheld you in your journey?
So I would say, First of all, part of the grace of being the church is that we're really awful just learning to fail better.
Like we all do fail, we fail each other.
And failing is not the end of everything.
So when I think about ways the church has fallen short, I think these are moments of falling short in the work of coming to understand each other, and it's not just
Our family, right? It's everybody, we're doing this together. I think a couple of times the church has had a really unhelpful vernacular around disability. Associations with disability, with tragedy, that inherently, my son's life is worse than a non-disabled person's life. Or that, I think for me, one thing in particular is to ascribe virtue to me because I parent a child with a disability.
I am not an exceptional parent for that reason.
I am just the parent of my particular child.
And so there have been moments when I think very well-meaning ascriptions of praise or virtue to me, I would have said are unwarranted, right?
I'm not so brave for having this on, as if I
folks suggesting to me that I can look forward to a heaven where my son is whole or where my son is able to communicate with me in unimpeded ways or how much better it will be for him. And on the other side, carries this assumption, right, that his body is going to change in the ways that we might find more typical. He is going to conform to a body that we would more easily recognize or we would assume has fewer challenges to it. I just don't know that that's true, right? I don't know that our bodies have to be resurrected in some particular normative model. I don't think we're all going to look alike, right? And some of the ways that we won't look alike have to do with our lives and what we've lived and experienced. And so for me, I don't know what it means for Jack's body to be changed in a resurrection. I think sometimes the church isn't helpful in offering me predictions about that, that suggest his life now is so much worse than it might be if he weren't living in the body that he's living in. And you ask me what the church is meant to uphold us, this would be one of them. Taking time to let me talk to y'all about Jack's story, reading the book, listening to, I think the best thing the church can do is ask a question like, what's it like? You know, who is Jack? What is Jack like? What should we know about Jack? And then asking what are Jack's needs in this space, in this moment, and giving families like ours time to figure out what that looks like. Often we want to help, and the impulse to help often overrides our ability or capacity to kind of wait and listen to what's actually needed. So I think some of the ways that churches have been particularly lovely to us in our experience is letting us come and articulate what it is that would be most helpful as we get to know the church and as Jack gets to know the church, so that we're not immediately, right, surrounded by care we might not benefit from or that Jack might not find helpful. So giving that time and that space, asking those questions, being willing to say that we don't know what people need until they tell us or until their caregivers can help us understand that, and then being responsive rather than sort of very, again, very well-meaningly proactive.
Yeah. That's great. The title of your book is, I think, intentionally provocative.
Yes.
Why did you choose that title, and tell us a little bit more about your daily work to forgive for that?
Yeah, so you might have to take it up with the Almighty. The title came to me in a time of not polite prayer. but you know, listen, I think I have lost the capacity, I think, for most of the politeness that we have with God in prayer. If you were to listen, yes, Lord, you listen to those prayers and you handle it, but I don't know if I would say a lot of them out loud. Certainly not the ones I was praying at the time I wrote this book. But the title kind of came to me in a moment of trying to understand what I was even doing writing. Why was I writing at all? And I said, I'm writing to forgive. I'm writing to forgive. And I walked into the room where my husband Preston was, and I said, the book is Forgiving God. Okay. So I think what I meant, what I'm learning to have meant by that title is not that I think God sinned against me, right? That's not a coherent idea, right? That God wronged me in some way. But that forgiveness is also about restoration of a relationship. And that for me, the feeling that something really irrevocably broke open when we got Jack's diagnosis, when I went through the season, I articulated in the book of totally new to me prayer for a miracle. I had been raised as Episcopalian. I was not part of a tradition or a family structure that necessarily prioritized that kind of prayer, prayer for a miraculous healing, that kind of name it and claim it. We are going to anoint this pregnancy and believe that God is going to do that. And man, I was out so far of the boat. I was on that water. I felt the night this irrevocable, miraculous revelation. And I think for me, it was the moment where you look out on the water the way that I imagine, right? Peter did. And you're like, I'm walking on water and I'm drowning. I have started to drown. And I, you know, I love that in scripture it says Jesus immediately reached out and grabbed Peter, but there's also an infinity of time before that hand is actually on you. And that's the space I think of when I think of what I had to restore in the relationship, is that infinite time where I realized that I was drowning and God had not yet grabbed my hand. Even though I know that however God understands time, those things all happen somehow all at once. But for me, it was, you did not grab my hand. You didn't grab my hand. I'm drowning. I don't know what to do. You did not do the thing I tried so hard to believe you could do. And so where are we? What are we going to do now? And that's a hard place to be. I think it is hard. I'm sure all of us have a kind of reckoning with God in our lives where there is this sense of a gap between what we know God to be, hope God to be for us and to us, maybe even the stories of who God has been to us and for us, and then this concrete reality we run into, and we think, where'd you go? Who are you? Because if you were who I knew you to be just 5 seconds ago, would I still be here? Would this still happen? And so I think forgiving God is coming back into a relationship where that question is a part of my relationship with God now. I would not say it's answered, but it's part of the fabric of what I understand God to be.
There's questions that I can't run some past.
Oh, great. Yeah. I love to try my question.
A couple of years ago, I read this essay written by a musician who, she was in her late 20s. Mm-hmm. She got diagnosed with stage 4 terminal cancer, and in the midst of that, her partner cheated on her and left. So, like, just unimaginable circumstances. But she wrote this essay about meeting God on the bathroom floor. Mm-hmm. When she was so sick from chemo and she was alone, and just a place where she didn't want to meet God.
Yeah.
But God was there anyway. And there's a number of stories in the book of kind of where maybe for you was the bathroom floor, was the NICU floor. Mm-hmm. What are some moments where God showed up in unexpected and very much at the time unwanted ways, but also deeply needful ways?
Yeah. Oh, good question. I feel like I can tell you all this story. This is actually a more recent story. So you can know that it's still happening all the time. Earlier this year, Jack was using the bathroom in the middle of the night, and the doorknob of the bathroom fell out. So he was stuck in the bathroom. And at night, Jack, so we're fortunate, we're very grateful, Jack's lungs functioned very, very well. And his joyful laughter would testify to that. It's quite loud. But at night, in order to keep him breathing when he sleeps on his back, his trach is not capped. So during the day when he's up and about, we cap it so he actually breathes through his nose and mouth to kind of help keep those airways going and keep that working. And then at night, we take it off. But when you take it off, it means the air is actually passing underneath the vocal cords. So if he's yelling, it's very, very challenging to hear him. So he's awake. What time is it? 2:30, maybe? And I wake up for no reason, but I am awake. And I know, and you know, when you wake up in the middle of the night, you don't Jesus does that. There's Jesus opening this door. There is God waking me up in the night and bringing me to the place where I am needed. And I go in and we have a long conversation on that bathroom floor about how lonely it was and how scary it was and how he felt really afraid. He was really alone. And by the mercy of Jesus, he then looks at me and he says, I'm ready to go back to sleep. So we go back to his bed, check him back in. He goes back to sleep. I sit on the couch and I say, okay, well, I still have a great conversation about this with my spiritual director soon. But also, that line from the Psalms that he who watches over you will never slumber or sleep, right? The Lord is your protector at your right hand, right? He will not let your foot be dashed against the stone, right? He will give his angels charge over thee. These are words that come to mean things to me now because I was on that bathroom floor, because I walked into that room and not into another room, because I woke up with the knowing that I was supposed to be awake, but no explanation as to why I needed to be awake.
So your background is in philosophy.
It sure is.
Specifically ethics. And an interesting through line in the book is how these philosophers and to probably most of us that are rather abstract philosophies become very deeply personal companions for you on this journey. And so I want to know how your background in philosophy and ethics shaped the choices that you and your sister's question that you all made during this time.
Yeah. Okay. I said the philosophy so much. I know other people don't love it, but let me tell you it's the best. Philosophy is amazing. Because what we all think philosophy is a lot of esoteric questions that have no connection to how we live our lives. But that's just like recent stuff. What happened for a really long time, the part of why I think I love it so much is that at the beginning, the question was how do we live a good human life? How do we live well with each other? How do we live well with ourselves? How do we live well with the divine? And we were so excited and so earnest, I think, in that question. That's where I see philosophy kind of starting. What does it mean to live a good human life? And so I think that was the first question that we asked. I remember sitting in this, I talk about that, I think, in the book. The hospital is undergoing renovations. And so I don't know if any of y'all have had a care conference ever in hospital context, but if you ever need to have kind of this interdisciplinary huddle with the medical team, you just make a whole care conference. And we had it in a basically like not quite refurbished like room closet. So they shoved a conference table in there and there's like all these chairs and everybody's kind of elbowing each other. And you have the plastic surgeon, you have the internal medicine person, you have the rounding NICU doctor, social work, child life, respiratory therapy, a nurse who specializes in cradle. Like everybody is sitting there. And Preston and I had been pretty worried about the trach. That is a huge undertaking. It's a very different kind of care that's needed. It would involve having a nurse clean at home overnight when Jack was younger. You're really just not sure about it. But I remember us asking the team, how will he flourish? Which of the options makes him have a more flourishing human life? And I only have that question because I love philosophy. I only had that question because what I wanted for my kid was not more or fewer medical interventions or even a particular picture of a flourishing life, but I wanted to know what they thought flourishing could mean for him and what of the options would most give us that. And I think the other place philosophy intersected for me is, and this is kind of another way I see God, maybe on the philosophical floor, down in the grit of it with me, is that I was already interested in philosophy of disability before I got pregnant with Jack. I gave my very first paper to my graduate student group on disability. there's suffering in the world, and sometimes you feel like, myself, like, why are people blind? Why are they in a wheelchair? Why are they deaf, etc.? And my paper was essentially about, I don't know that God always has to have an explanation for that. Those might just be different ways that bodies are, and they're not always bad. It's not always worse to have a different kind of body. And I gave that paper, I was 7 weeks pregnant with Jack, knew nothing about him. And then I gave that paper, and I started working on a different paper, kind of on the same lines, and we got a diagnosis. And I think, oh, you brought me the philosophy before you brought me my kid. Does that mean you knew, right? You wove together the kind of thinking I was going to need to do to become an advocate for my son as preparation for becoming his parent.
So a tough moment in the beginning of the first beginning of the book is shortly after you all get Jack's diagnosis. You are asked by the doctor if you all want to keep Jack.
Yes.
And kind of implicit in those questions is what you're just talking about, that having a different body, or having a disabled body, automatically means a life that isn't worth living. You're becoming an Episcopal priest, and you're very much a denomination that supports women's right to choose and bodily autonomy. And yet, eugenic history and philosophy has crept through that same door. How do we support women and agency and empowerment and bringing back rights to their body that have been stripped from them, and also reject eugenic mindsets that have come through that as well? And also, like, that's a sort of clinical question. What is a word of compassion and grace for people who aren't in a situation to make the same choice that you did?
She asked everybody these tough questions. So, a couple of thoughts. These are thoughts. Please feel free to disagree with me and push back, because I'm off the cuff a little bit here. One thought is that these questions, the view of disability that I hold, the goal of that view is to understand the depth of the context of how our bodies and our lives intersect. Jack's conditions are such that with the right kinds of medical support, those disabilities are not incredibly restrictive. And we are incredibly fortunate that that diagnosis was not accompanied by what is often the case, a very short life prognosis or other kinds of congenital conditions that severely restrict the way a person can live in that body. And it is a very, very challenging reality that disability is a term that we use to talk about a really, really wide spectrum of bodies and a wide spectrum of ways those bodies interact with our lives. So the view of disability I have is that every time we have to ask a question about how somebody's life is going, we've got to know so much more than just what their body looks like. We have to know so much more about what kinds of supports they have, what kinds of context they're in, what might be possible with medical intervention, and what those medical interventions might even mean for someone's quality of life. So when I think about how to ask these questions ethically, the first thing I want to do is say we have to resist the idea that one piece of information is enough to make a decision. But I also think we have to have a well of compassion that we cannot even fathom for how quiet and devastating some of that discernment is. And it is imperfect and it's imprecise. Again, right, I can't really reason well from the choices I was able to make towards what choices might be available or not available to other families, and also what kinds of disabilities that folks who have social structure supports contexts to be capable of receiving with real substantial support bodies that need a lot more care, a lot more attention, or a lot more specialized services and supports. And when we're working towards that, and we meet with, again, a well of space and compassion and attention, then we are maybe possible of helping everybody, ourselves included, imagine a world where the supports for people, adults and children who have disabilities, is such that it's easier to envision a very rich, robust, flourishing life. Yeah. I don't know how to do
that.
Life and the work that
so much. You said you have two other children.
Yes.
And I'm the grandmother of a child with special needs. And I'm wondering, how do you help the siblings feel, you know, get that they get the time, attention, and especially attention and support while you're spending so much time, attention and support for the special kiddo?
Yeah. Oh, what an excellent question. So the first thing I'll say is that we've tried, as our girls have grown, to share pretty honestly with them why our time might look different than other families. And you know, in our house, I have pointed to this is not an equal house, but this is a just house. So this might not be a fair, right? My girls are at the developmental stage where like they're very concerned about fairness. Is the cake the same amount of cake? Is it a different shape of cake? And if I add like if the hot water is poured 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but somebody's counting faster, then maybe we should pour some of the water for the tea into the other cup so that they're the same amount. But from the beginning, what we've told our girls is that we can't measure time in our family that way. Because some things with Jack take more time. And we've shown them, they see all the medical things that we do with Jack as much as they're able to. And so we talk about that a lot. We say, you know, it's not, we can't go for fairness, but we can go for justice. We can go for, and for me, justice means your needs are as seen by me as his needs. And though his needs might take up more time, your needs do not get take up less attention. I try to spend time with all my kids one-on-one every day, even if it's not again, the same amount of time. And we also spend time as a family reinforcing that my girls are not co-parents, they're not co-caregivers. We try to say that pretty regularly, and they are, and, you know, this is part of the givenness of having this kind of family, is often the siblings understand at a very deep intuitive level that they have a care, they want to care, they have an intuition towards caregiving. And so I think part of how I try to attend to them is actually to set some boundaries around their own sense of needing to be Jack's caretakers. And your kids, that's not your job. Oh, do I need to stop and watch him in the pool if you're that? I say, no, that's my job. My job is to make sure that he's in the pool safe. Your job is to do a 360 jump and tell a joke, right? Like, and so I think that would be one thing. I hear it. It's hard. And I think we're doing it imperfectly. One thing I'm grateful for in having Jack as my first is that when my girls were born, I remember thinking, you will show me your needs. Jack showed us a lot of his needs right up front. But every kid has special needs. Every kid has particular needs, unique needs. And so when I think about that, I sort of think my girls are just going to reveal those in a different way and probably at different stages of their life. But the same attitude I have about caring for Jack's needs now is the attitude I will have as their needs get revealed.
I hope I can articulate this, but one of the things I'm really interested in that you talked about is being honest, and that we all fail, and in the church we say the wrong thing, or we're not helpful, and I think that a lot, we can learn a lot from your experience in how we engage with each other in church, and I just wonder if what you might say, or what lessons we can get when we all go through our own struggles, and this is kind of part of Chad's sermon today too, but just like we go through our own struggles and we want to be there for each other, but it's difficult. So I don't know if I have so much of a question, but I think there's a lot to be learned from your experience and how we help each other in church.
Yeah, you know, I think it starts too with daring to tell God our very unpleasant feelings. Daring to say, I am angry with you for what you've done, or I don't us more willing to understand when others are also feeling that same desire to flee, that same desire to be angry or wrestle. And I think when we fear it less in our own relationships, then we don't fear it on other people's path. And I think that helps with our like sharing things honestly with each other. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So what would be kind of your goal in how the church could integrate Jack as an individual member of the community, not you as an adult or your family, but he is his own person? So what does that look like for him? And what does that look like for parents of small children that would be his friend?
Yeah.
How could we integrate him more fully?
Oh, what a great question. So the first thing I would say is,
that you're wrestling with that don't stick well with you.
stories I read a lot when I was pregnant with Jack. And I read it out of the Jesus Free Book Bible. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that Bible. It has a very lovely cadence to it. The story, I don't know how to say his name. Jairus's daughter. Yeah. Okay. You know, I've got him. No. They have been telling that story really beautifully in that Bible. Because there's this line when on the way to heal the daughter, the woman who has been suffering from bleeding for years reaches out to touch the hem of his robe. And, you know, the disciples in the way that Jesus sort of Bible tells it, they say something like, we don't have time, great opportunity, we don't have time. And there's a line, and it says, Jesus always had time. Jesus always had time. And I used to say that to myself all the time. Jesus still has time to heal you. Jesus still has time. I went through, I got an ultrasound every month. I had a fetal MRI. We were never told anything different from the first time he was diagnosed. And every time, I was like, you still have time. Because Jesus always had time. That woman suffered for 12 years, and Jesus had time. And she didn't even have to do anything. Jesus didn't even have to talk to her, right? And so I remember thinking, even in the NICU, I was like, you cloak could walk by, you can just walk by. I don't even need a big mirror, but I could just use a little one. And you just did that for that woman on her way to do something else. You can just be on your way to do a miraculous healing for another baby in this NICU, and you can just like give us a little like blowback miracle power or something. That story is really hard for me now. I remember a mentor of mine at the time saying, and I thought it off and on maybe every day for the last 10 years, sometimes you're the house next door. Jesus doesn't go everywhere. It doesn't go to every house. And sometimes you're the house with the kid who didn't get visited. What do you do? Because you know Jesus can do these things. And sometimes Jesus does. And we have these stories of Jesus doing these things. And I have not given up my belief in those things. But when I read those stories, what I hear is I was the next door house. So I wrestle with those. I also think I wrestle with the I was going to say I wrestle with Revelation, but I wrestle with Revelation just in general because I'm like, this is not very helpful information about anything that I would like to know about. I'm like, okay, so we're healing the nations with some the trees and the leaves and the stuff, and we've got no tears, no crying, no pain, but I'm like, okay, that feels very far off. And what does that mean? Are you gonna, like, I don't know, and I want to know what that entails, and I don't, and that's frustrating to me, so I wrestle with that too. I mean, I think part of the gift of Scripture is that we are given glimpses, and that's it. Just glimpses into people's stories. And there's as many miracles that don't get written down as there are houses that didn't get a miracle. We just have the stories we have.
Yeah. One more question, and then, yeah, maybe the last one. Yeah, right there. Yes.
There is so much of that. focus our attention so much on what is often like the dominant conversation about disability that tends to be like equal access to education or inclusion in kind of these child-centric conversations, because of course there are adults with disabilities who need the same kind of wondering, open, gentle welcome, and who get to stay for themselves what that looks like and what that means. But I think it's important just to remember that. I happen to be currently parenting a disabled child, but he will grow into an adult who will articulate his own needs and have probably his own conversation on his stage someday.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.